I'm Robin Young. It's here and now in a few minutes. If you can, eat local first. But what if you can't? Well, here's some of the debate in the movement to eat locally grown food. But first, the legacy of Martin Luther King was invoked at a rally in Columbia, South Carolina today. All three Democratic presidential frontrunners spoke at the rally, which sets the stage for South Carolina's heated Democratic primary on Saturday. How the candidates resonate with African American voters will be a key to winning that state, since more than half of Democratic voters there are African American. We spoke with Jeff Zeleny of the New York Times at the rally a little earlier today.
Well, Robin, as we speak right now, Senator Obama is midway through his address. He's standing on the steps of the South Carolina Capitol to a crowd of perhaps a few thousand people. They're responding very well. He received a big reception when he marched up to the Capitol. This is clearly his crowd. This is clearly a lot of people have come out to see him. But certainly there is are a number of signs in the audience, in the crowd, for Senator Clinton and a few for John Edwards as well. So in South Carolina, as in other places, the African-American vote is certainly not monolithic, and I think we'll see that here this week, and we'll find out what people think on Saturday.
Well, you and others have said that this is sort of a tricky path to walk on this particular campaign trail section today, because the candidates called a truce on issues of race after their recent spats. But this is a day when people talk about race. And for Barack Obama in particular, this is a shift for him. Tell us about that.
It's a bit of a shift for him. For the last year of his campaign, primarily as he's reached out to voters in Iowa and New Hampshire, which are largely populated by white voters, he has not talked about race, and the race has not been at the forefront of his campaign. But now, in the as we enter the period of the South Carolina primary, as well as other primaries going on to February 5th, black voters will be key to his success, key to his candidacy, particularly as he is struggling to win over some women voters, which have gone to Senator Clinton in the opening contest. So now a race is definitely at the forefront of this campaign more than it ever has been. And it's striking when we're standing here in South Carolina, as he is speaking right now, the Confederate flag is blowing in the wind, not more than 40 yards from him. So all of those old tensions have certainly not gone away, and this will be a fascinating week on the campaign trail.
Well, Hillary Clinton got a key endorsement from an influential black leader in New York yesterday, the Reverend Calvin Butts, who said his wasn't a race-based decision. And others are saying that this is emphasizing something of a generation gap, older African-Americans and maybe more establishment African-Americans backing Clinton, Obama appealing to younger voters. Are you seeing that?
No question about it. A lot of the people I'm looking at right now holding signs for Senator Obama are indeed younger African-Americans. And he certainly has worked out to reach the new generation of people, particularly black pastors as well. He was speaking at Ebenezer Baptist Church yesterday, the historic church of Dr. King in Atlanta. And the pastor is a 38-year-old reverend, and he invited Senator Obama. It's one example of this new generation of leadership who he is reaching out to. But once again, one person who we will also see a lot from this week in South Carolina is Bill Clinton. He'll be spending the entire week here. Senator Clinton actually may not, but so in some respects, the competition is between Barack Obama and Bill Clinton this week in South Carolina, which is also one more part of this fascinating drama.
And just to briefly to mention John Edwards, of course, from South Carolina, the senator from North Carolina, but he's expected to pull some white voters from Hillary Clinton, but obviously he will have backers in that state as well.
He will, and he is speaking right now on the steps of the Capitol. He has just started talking, and he is getting a good reception as well. There are a lot of Democrats who are wondering, why is he still in this race? He certainly has the hardest road to hoe of any of the candidates, but his support here among white voters could certainly play a role in this.
Well,
Support from Senator Clinton or even from Senator Obama. So he's still a factor in this race.
Jeff Zeleny of the New York Times covering the Democratic presidential candidates there in Columbia, South Carolina. Jeff, thank you.
Robin, thank you.
Locavore. It was the word of the year in 2007 for the new Oxford American Dictionary. But by that point, old hat for Jessica Prentice and her friends in San Francisco. They came up with the word in 2005 to describe themselves, people who eat food grown locally. Well, now it's a worldwide movement, and why not? Local food is fresher, it keeps local economies strong, and locavores say it cuts down on global warming because it eliminates the tons of carbon emissions caused by transporting food thousands of miles around the world. In fact, supermarkets have begun adding a food miles count on packaging so consumers can know their carbon mileage. But a study from New Zealand's Lincoln University says mileage isn't always the best way to determine green benefits, and that's gotten furious feedback from foodies. Well, James McWilliams is a visiting scholar at Yale University this year. He's waded into the fray, partly on the side of the New Zealand study, with an op-ed in the New York Times. We spoke with him about his last book, A Revolution in Eating, How the Quest for Food Shaped America. And so, James, we now welcome you back.
Thank you for having me.
How would you describe yourself on the whole local food thing?
Well, I'm a strong supporter of local eating. It's something I try to do as much as I can when it's feasible. At the same time, I am not a radical locavore in the sense that I think that there are limits to what locavores can achieve. And so what I try to do is preserve the locavore ethic while at the same time thinking about sustainability in global terms.
Well, let's get at some of your concerns. In a piece you wrote for the New York Times and a longer article in Texas Observer, you wonder about the premise that reducing food miles, for instance, is necessarily good for the environment. Let's start with that. And this Lincoln University study, it claimed to find that lamb exported from New Zealand to Britain, brought from New Zealand to Britain by sea, had a smaller carbon footprint than lamb that was raised in Britain and sold in Britain. First of all, how can that be? What was the rationale behind that study?
It is counterintuitive. And the study, although not a perfect study, was strongly suggestive in focusing on transportation and showing that transportation is just one factor in the overall energy inputs that go into the production of a particular food, in this case, lamb. I think very often one problem with the locavore emphasis is we tend to think transportation, food miles, food miles. And the danger of that was revealed by the Lincoln study. There are vast numbers of other inputs that we have to pay attention to. Water usage, fertilizer usage, the use of greenhouses or not, tillage, packaging, and not just the distance, but the kind of transportation that was used. There's a radical difference between whether a product is flown, whether it's trucked, whether it's sent by train or by boat. And so you have this possibly infinite range of factors that need to be considered. To focus just on transportation, as the study revealed through a counterintuitive conclusion, is to possibly miss the larger environmental benefits.
Well, now you quote local food advocates, including one from the Yale Sustainable Food Project, as saying that at its core the study is valid. But Michael Schumann, author of Small Mart, has written a rebuttal. He writes, the study's lead authors were, first of all, from New Zealand agribusiness with a stake in exporting animals. New Zealand uses, for instance, hydroelectric dams. Sheep in Britain come with a carbon price tag because of all the dirty coal plants there. He says, you know, fix those and you've evened the playing field. He says the study didn't take into account the emissions produced trucking the New Zealand sheep once they got to Britain. You're shaking your head yes. So
sure.
There were some flaws.
These are all valid points, I think, and the study is not perfect. Now, this isn't to say that transportation doesn't matter. It's just to say, look, there are a number of other factors that we need to take into consideration. And so while you could argue that the New Zealand study compared apples and oranges, I mean, pasture-raised lamb in New Zealand versus conventionally raised lamb in England, at the same time, I think we need to back up and say, well, why is that? Why is lamb grown conventionally more often in England, whereas in New Zealand it is raised according to what we might call organic standards? And
I should say that was another criticism from Michael Schumann, who says that they were comparing apples and oranges because they didn't compare the kiwi lamb, you know, lamb from New Zealand, with an organic lamb in Britain. And there are organic lambs in Britain.
There absolutely are organic lamb in Britain. But at the same time, if Britain was going to produce cheap lamb for millions of people, doing it according to the New Zealand standards would be virtually impossible. I mean, there's a reason why the production is taking place the way it's taking place in England and the way it's taking place in New Zealand, and it has to do with comparative advantage.
Well, and this isn't your only concern about the local first movement, but I just want to, one last thought. You say we have to take take into consideration other things. But most of us can't. You know, we don't have the time. So it just makes sense to make it simpler by saying, you know what, I'm not going to, as Bill McKibben writes, eat peas or carrots that come 2,000 miles from California or potatoes that come 2,000 miles from Idaho if I can get them in my own neighborhood.
And I think that's, for the most part, a fair approach. I'm not disagreeing with that, but at the same time, I'm saying we can't universalize that because there are a number of places where that's just not a feasible attitude to have. There are a number of places where only certain goods can be sustainably produced, and you'd have to radically limit your diet. And, you know, it raises a really important issue, which is the locavore ethic. It certainly has its place, but not everywhere. Even where I live in Central Texas, if I were going to limit my diet to sustainable local production, my diet would change radically.
What would you eat?
Well, I would eat a lot of beef, which is something that I eat very little of right now. And I would eat anything you could coax from the paddle of a prickly pear. And there are certainly people who do that. Lots of root vegetables. All tasty foods, but I also crave a diverse diet. You know, if individuals want to make those decisions, I do not in any way think that's a problem. But at the same time, I think we need to recognize that this is an issue that's going to require thinking beyond individual dietary decisions.
Well, in fact, you are critical of authors like Bill McKibben and Barbara Kingsolver in that, as you say, they have a certain amnesia in writing about their own eating of local foods. For instance, Barbara Kingsolver moved from Arizona to Virginia to do that, whereas Arizona is an arid desert land and can't grow the things that she was growing.
Right. I mean, I'm gently critical of these authors. I generally find the thrust of their argument to be very beneficial and convincing. At the same time, this, what I think is an overemphasis on eating local, it really does ignore the fact that a lot of Americans, if we just want to talk about the United States, a lot of people living in the United States live where, you know, eating a diverse, sustainable diet that's local is really not an option.
Give us an example of one of the things, for instance, that Barbara Kingsolver rhapsodized about that maybe wouldn't be able to be grown back in Arizona.
A good example there would be asparagus. This is something that grows much more efficiently in Southern Virginia than it does in a desert. One of the things that I have struggled with as I research these issues is to come up with a sort of top 10 list. You know, here's how you as an individual can eat a sustainable diet. It's a very difficult thing to do. And I'm skeptical when I am told that these are the things that I can do. And the reason why I feel that way is we just have so little information. We talk about the Lincoln University study. It's a unique study. Life cycle assessments, a kind of overall analysis of the energy inputs into a product, are so few and far between because we've spent a lot more time documenting the distance food has traveled that we don't have an enormous amount of information to work with.
That's food historian James McWilliams. He's been saying that we need to ask, is it better to, for instance, purchase lambs from New Zealand raised on plentiful grass there, or use fertilizer and water to grow grass where it doesn't grow? Of course, his critics say, well, let's just grow organic animals everywhere. He says he wants us to look at the bigger picture. We will when we come back. And later, don't forget the delegate count in the presidential race. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from food historian James McWilliams. He says choosing what we eat based just on how far it's traveled to us isn't always best. He wants to radically overhaul the food system so stores like Whole Foods, for instance, would factor in things like water usage or whether product was trucked or taken by more fuel-efficient trains. They'd decide so consumers wouldn't have to. But James says, you know, Whole Foods has its critics who say they grow acres of organic food in California, for instance, and then truck it. They don't buy as much locally as their critics want them to.
Yeah, and I think that at the same time, what Whole Foods is doing, serving millions of people, is quite admirable. I think one of the dangers in this current discussion that's happening about local food is the terms tend to be highly polarized. Culinary ideologies sort of go at each other quite viciously, and you know what I try to do as I think about these issues is take a pragmatic approach that seeks an acceptable common ground. I mean, there's this really wonderful Chinese proverb that I continually go back to, which says that, you know, people who have food have many problems, and people who don't have food have one problem. And we have many problems. One of the many problems we have is how to produce this stuff sustainably, and a problem is a problem for a reason. It's very difficult to solve, and so to just say, I'm going to buy my food local and that's going to solve this problem is, I think, short-sighted at best.
Well, in fact, you are critical of people who might, you know, get their little straw bag and go buy local food and then jump in their SUV and go to their second home. Does the local food movement, as much as you support it, does it, in your mind, let people off the hook in some way of paying attention to bigger issues?
Yeah. We live in a highly commercialized consumer society, and so it's unfair sometimes to point out people's hypocrisies. It's almost too easy to do. At the same time, I think that, you know, to make a decision to eat local and to focus only on that does have a tendency to turn into kind of a lifestyle choice. It does have a tendency to be perceived as a kind of greenwashing, as they're calling it. And what I mean by that is, you know, to focus on food miles, it can turn food miles into sort of a red herring so that you are overlooking other environmental issues.
Well, what are some of the things that you would like to see people pay attention to?
I think one of the most important factors that we have to pay attention to is comparative advantage. What I mean by that is looking at the geographical conditions of a certain area and asking if the food produced in that area is consistent with what that area is capable and most efficient at producing. So, you know, if you're buying your tomatoes locally in an area that's having to import water, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're making an environmentally sound decision. I think it's really critical that we develop a pretty sensitive knowledge of how different regions of our country and the world are naturally capable of producing goods more efficiently than other places. Another factor to really consider is something you hear very little about, but the use of tillage. I mean, tillage is something that is incredibly detrimental to the soil. At the same time, as far as I know, organic farmers till the soil all the time.
And tillage is bad for the soil because the soil blows and
it increases runoff, the topsoil is going to disperse it more easily. And so might it make just as much sense to include on a particular food product not just the food miles, but whether the water was imported, whether it was tilled or no tillage, how much fertilizer was used and what kind of fertilizer was used? Factors like these that, you know, a focus on food miles doesn't allow us to really think carefully about. And one of the ideas that I've honestly just thrown out to think in terms of a kind of hub and spoke system of food distribution. And what's so interesting to me about this is at the turn of the 20th century, there were food systems analysts who would go into cities and figure out the most efficient ways for food to move around the city, just like they did with water and other utilities. And then these food systems and analysts sort of disappeared for a while. And I think we need them back. And I think we need to start thinking about food distribution on a global scale that focuses on comparative advantage, that focuses on economy of scale, that acknowledges the reality that no matter how localvore you are, food is going to move. It's a reality of our post-industrial society. And I think that there could be tremendous advantages to be gained by making sure that food is moving from a place where it was most efficiently produced and that it was moving in the most efficient manner. All of this sounds not nearly as sexy as I'm going to eat within 100 miles of my house. That's far more exciting. But at the same time, I think those issues are equally important.
James McWilliams, visiting scholar at Yale University. For more on the local food debate, go to our website, here-now.org. And a quick nod now to sports. Our undefeated New England Patriots having beaten the San Diego Chargers last night. The New York Giants upset the Green Bay Packers. Newsday's Arthur Staple is on the line from Wisconsin. Arthur, when our Pats almost lost to your Giants 3 weeks ago, I worried they'd meet again, and here they go to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic, at least from the Giants' perspective, how they've got to the Super Bowl. They lost to the Cowboys and Packers the first 2 weeks of the season, and they beat those two teams each of the last 2 weeks to get here, and now they can try to redeem themselves one more time against New England.
Well, our quarterback, Tom Brady, is, of course, potentially one of the best ever, but he had three interceptions last night. Your guy, Eli Manning, Peyton Manning's little brother, he seems on fire.
Yeah, and he certainly needed to stay warm. storm last night when it was the wind chills were 23 below out here in Lambeau Field, and he's gone through all three playoff games without an interception, and I think that's been one of the hugest keys to them getting this far. He's really matured a lot.
Okay, so you just had to make it clear that it was colder in Green Bay than it was here, where it was like minus 5 or something with the wind chill. But they're going to meet in Arizona on February 3rd. What are your thoughts?
You know, ever since they played the Patriots in that last game, and they played like they had nothing to lose, and that's really what's carried them through these playoffs. They're playing as if they have nothing to lose. They're always the underdogs. They're going to go out to Arizona and be the hugest underdog in recent Super Bowl memory, and I think the Giants love it that way.
Arthur, just tell us honestly, does everyone across the country hate us?
Well, you know, I think that's what people say about the Giants. I think that this will be one of the highest-rated Super Bowls ever just because of who hates which team more.
Newsday sports writer Arthur Staple in the airport, actually. Meet you here February 3rd.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Robin.
And how are we going to do this? Right after February 3rd comes February 5th, Super-Duper Tuesday, back after the news with the delegate count going into that day here and now. It's all about the delegates. And according to the delegate count, the presidential nominating process is up for grabs. Over the weekend, John McCain picked up 19 delegates with a narrow win over Mike Huckabee in the Republican primary in South Carolina. Mitt Romney pretty much ignored South Carolina, focused on the Nevada caucuses, and came away with the win and 17 delegates. Hillary Clinton won the Democratic Nevada caucus, but because of the way the rules are set up in that state, Barack Obama may have earned more delegates than she did. Confused? That's okay. Bob Bennison is editor of CQPolitics.com. He's with us. Bob, CQ Politics is using the Associated Press's delegate count. Now, we know it's just a snapshot. It could change. But what does it say? Start with the Democrats. Who's ahead?
Barack Obama has a small lead over Hillary Clinton, but nothing outstanding.
Really?
Yeah.
Because we were seeing a count where Hillary Clinton had 236 and Barack Obama 136.
Exactly. Because there's also a category in the Democratic Party called superdelegates. They're party leaders and elected officials who are given automatic delegate slots to the convention. It's almost all members of Congress, all the Democratic governors, big city mayors. And while they're officially uncommitted, a lot of them are endorsing either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or John Edwards, who's still in the race. So the Associated Press is polling these people, and they're counting their endorsements as delegate votes for each of the candidates. Well,
okay.
Hillary Clinton has more establishment support, so therefore you're seeing that alternative count, which shows her with a fairly substantial lead over Obama. But none of that is official.
Well, let's look at the Republican side.
Right now, Romney and Huckabee have delegate totals that are in the 50s.
I have a number here. Mitt Romney, 59. Mike Huckabee, 40. John McCain, 36.
Every state has a different way of doing this.
The Republican Party, unlike the Democrats, allows every state to decide whether to use the winner-take-all method or
That's
a
right.
proportional method.
That's
and,
right.
And then you have to throw in that they also have a sort of undecided factor as well.
Yes. What we're seeing as this thing turns for the Republicans to Florida is that the race will be fully joined for the first time. Rudy Giuliani made a calculated decision, very risky, very unorthodox, concentrating almost all of his time in Florida. The Republican Party set a threshold of February 5th for all states to hold their primary. Anyone who went before that and had an actual delegate allocation event has had their delegate number for the Republican National Convention sliced in half.
So we remind ourselves the delegate count in Florida is disputed because the party's angry at the state, as it was
exactly.
Angry at Michigan for going early. But mm-hmm. there's a good chance that Rudy Giuliani could take all of the delegates there, and suddenly he'd be, looking pretty healthy. Because if you get the delegates, then you get the momentum and you get more pledges of delegates, and on you go.
If Giuliani can pull this off, it would revolutionize this whole nominating process.
Bob Benenson, editor of CQPolitics.com, with an attempt at giving us the delegate count. Bob, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Well, we turn now to Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He's also editor of the upcoming book, Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s. It's going to be published in March. And Julian, you're watching these races as well. First of all, is this unusual for them to be so wide open?
Yeah, I mean, it's been many decades since we've had this kind of race where there's no clear front runner, and we're in both parties. It's really hard to tell you know, who's going to be the winner by the convention.
Well, I was going to say, do you think this is one of those years, which we haven't had in decades, when we may not know going into the conventions late summer?
We'll see. I think it's still a little early to make the whole prediction of a brokered convention like we had in 1952 and 48. You know, we still have this big Super Tuesday coming up, and primaries are still the way in which we select our candidates. So I think there's still a lot of room for one of the candidates, especially in the Democratic Party, to really move ahead.
Well, let's remind ourselves, the brokered conventions, that means the nominations were not decided on the first ballot. Candidates weren't really coronated prior to the conventions. It happened during. Very exciting. Not that I remember it. The last time it took more than one ballot to select the Republican nominee was 1948. As you mentioned, that's when New York Governor Thomas Dewey, who was also the GOP nominee in 44, had to go three ballots to win. Let's listen to a little of his acceptance speech at the convention in Philadelphia.
You have given here in this hall a moving and dramatic proof of how Americans who honestly differ, close ranks and move forward for the nation's well-being, shoulder to shoulder.
Julian, the historian, remind us. I mean, what was that night like?
That was an exciting night. I mean, Dewey is defeating Robert Taft from Ohio, who's more of an establishment, old guard conservative, Dewey being a New York liberal Republican. And this is an era so different than ours in that during the conventions, that's when people still, you know, were decided. There was deals made. Party leaders were really in charge of the process. This is before the 1970s when we switched to the system we have now of primaries and caucuses. So there was an aura of excitement that we no longer have with these conventions. Although we might have it again.
Well, the last time the Democrats had to go more than one ballot was in 52. Then-Governor of Illinois Adlai Stevenson wound up with the nomination, even though he didn't campaign for it at the convention in Chicago. Tell us about that.
That was a little similar to today with the Republicans in that the Democratic Party was fractured and divided. Truman was very unpopular by 1952, and it was an era when the nation faced some big issues. And Stevenson is really brought in at the last minute because the front runner in the primaries, Senator Kefauver, was not well-liked by the party leaders. And so Stevenson gets the nomination, and obviously he's defeated by Eisenhower. But this is another case where it's really at the last minute, it's really at the convention that the decision is made rather than earlier.
Yeah. What you know, as we look at the count now, you know, what's your thinking when you see, for instance, candidates not go to states where everybody else goes, Mitt Romney going to Nevada and making the strategic move to pick up the delegates there, even though all of the press or most of the press went to John McCain. And then we see that now Mitt Romney is ahead in the delegate count.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have a very interesting case where the Republicans are so fractured, they're focusing on particular states and each focusing on a particular type of constituency. You don't have coalition builders in the Republican Party. But as a result, you have a kind of wide-open system where each time we have one of these primaries, all of a sudden the calculation changes. And sometimes the numbers don't look like the coverage. And here you have a case where Romney might be in a little better shape than he seems.
We're going to, later in the week, talk about the fight over the souls of both parties, you know, parties that we're watching unfold. But just in the few seconds we have, I mean, that's a part of what's going on now as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's part of the interesting part. It's not just a candidate-centered race. In both parties, I think there's a real fight over what the ideas of the party should be, what the policies of the party should be. So part of these divisions are healthy, and I think it's partly a healthy debate that's going on for both sides.
And by the way, this year's conventions, the Republicans will meet in St. Paul, Minnesota, Democrats in Denver, Colorado. And as you say, it might just be a year when they're up late that night. Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go today, The Astonishing Life of Octavian Nothing. You're listening to Here and Now. For the several hundred residents of Reeves, Louisiana, it took way too long to hear this message from their phone company.
The number you have dialed, 666, 2613 has been changed.
For four decades, residents of Reeves have been fighting to change their exchange. Until last week, 666 was the telephone exchange in this small town, but it made some in the predominantly Christian community nervous because 666 is the sign of the beast from the Bible's Book of Revelations. Well, Mayor Scott Walker is one of those who was nervous. He joins us on the line. And Mr. Mayor, what kinds of things, like what would people say to you when you gave out your phone number?
They would go, "Whoa. Wait a minute. Do you know what that is? You know what that means?"
What?
Say, "Yeah, it's just a number." And they would say, "Yeah, but y'all got to change that, you know."
Well, you say, you know, told them it's just a number, but what does it mean to you?
The number itself, unless it was put on your right hand, top of your right hand, or your forehead, I really don't think it would have any difference one way or another. But as mayor, I feel like it's my duty to project this town, to try to grow this town, get new businesses in here, new people in here. I think it's a bad stigma, and it's just generally a black eye on the town.
Yeah.
And myself personally, I did not enjoy having 666 or dialing it. Well, like I said, I have no fear of it.
Well, Revelation 13:18, to those who don't know, reads, "If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666.
Right.
Now, on the face of it, that doesn't sound, you know, all that. But what do Christians think that the beast is?
The beast is the Antichrist, which will be Satan's son, and he'll be coming to the earth to take and rule and reign during the what we call tribulation period. And it says it is a mark of a man. So it's calling out a certain man here.
Well, and then we see that scholars believe that the 666 may have been a reference to the Roman emperor at the time that the Book of Revelations was written because, of course, Roman emperors put Christians to death, and under a certain counting system, when you give letters numbers and they add up to things like Nero, you know.
Right.
And then the other researchers have found other manuscripts from the 3rd century or 11th century that have put, you know, said that the number is actually 665 or 616. So, but you know, you're telling me that your citizens take this very seriously.
Well, we're a very strong Christian community, and we're a lot of people here that love the Lord and profess Jesus Christ as their Savior, and I being one of them and proud to do that. Far as the manuscripts go, the two most ancient and seem to be most reliable still have the number as 666, which is 666.
What do you think about what other people think about you? I mean, there's a town outside of Boston that has the 666 exchange, and I don't know that anyone's really talked about it. And towns across the country, and, you know, 666 on addresses, and you know, what do you think about what others might think of that, changing it?
Well, like I said, it's a stigma we've lived under. We took it on here recently, and we had to elevate it to the level of our United States senators and one of our United States congressmen to all get this changed.
Hey, by the way, there's 100 who haven't changed it. What do folks think of that?
The 100 that haven't changed said it really doesn't bother them one way or another. Nobody's keeping it because, ooh, we want to because we love Satan. No, it's nothing like that. Matter of fact, I'm going to tell you a real quick story.
Please.
Lady calls City Hall, and she says, "Mayor, I want to keep my phone number, but you don't understand why." And I said, "No, ma'am, why?" She said, "Because it reminds me who I've been married to for the past 40 years. So I busted out laughing. And I called our public service commissioner, and he started laughing. And during the public commissioner board meeting, he included that in their agenda, so it was on public record.
Scott Walker, mayor of Reeves, Louisiana. Mayor Walker, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Still ahead today, the story of the American slave who fought for his freedom with the British during the Revolutionary War. Back in 1 minute, here and now. M.T. Anderson's The Astonishing Life of Octavian Nothing, Traitor to the Nation, Volume 1, The Pox Party, won the 2006 National Book Award for Young People's Literature and comes out in paperback tomorrow. The young boy at the center, Octavian, thinks he's living an enchanted life. After all, he and his mother, Cassiopeia, an African princess, are cared for by men so magical they could be wizards.
The men who raised me were lords of matter, and in the dim chambers I watched as they traced the spinning of bodies celestial in vast iron courses, and bid sparks to dance upon their hands. They read the bodies of fish as if each dying trout or shad was a fresh biblical testament, the wet and twitching volume of a newborn Pentateuch. They burned holes in the air, wrote poems of love, sucked the venom from sores, painted landscapes of gloom, and made metal sing. They dissected fire like newts.
Ah, but Octavian soon discovers he and his mother were African royalty, but are now slaves. Those lords of matter are scientists studying Octavian to see if blacks are inferior to whites. And what feels futuristic is, in fact, taking place in Boston right before the Revolution, an event that Octavian will become caught up in. It's a plunge into a Boston more gothic than fife and drum as Octavian escapes the scientists and fights alongside white minutemen. We spoke with M.T. Anderson when Octavian Nothing first came out and asked how much is true. Were there experimental societies in revolutionary America?
There were experimental societies of this kind. There were versions of this experiment carried on, I believe, at Harvard in the late 17th century. There was an attempt to do this kind of thing with Native Americans. And then I think also at the College of William and Mary, they also did a similar experiment to see if Native Americans could pick up classical education.
How would you characterize how these scientists feel about Octavian? Because at times in the beginning, they would seem to love him. They teach him languages and music. He plays the violin beautifully. But it's also punishing at times.
Well, it's that coldness of seeing someone merely as an experimental subject.
And yet again, you don't know that until this story starts to unfold. And then, Octavian's mother gets a stark reminder that she is indeed a slave. And without giving anything away, at times this is often so dark. Is it a book for young readers? What age would you put it at?
I don't know. I actually did not think about the age when I was writing it because it seemed to me so important to try to capture what the character would say rather than to corral him in a particular direction.
And what do you think now, having written it?
I would definitely say that it would be for 16 and older.
Right. Yeah. Because we said it's very dark. But it also has elements of the fantastical, you know, the mm-hmm. books that kids are reading, the Harry Potter and such. Did you do that purposefully?
Definitely. One of the ideas of writing the book was that I wanted to kind of conceal from the reader where the setting was and what period it was in, because I feel like we know our national myths so well that it's very hard for us to understand how that period might have appeared to those who didn't yet know that the Revolution, for example, would be won by this set of colonists, and who didn't know that they were going to sunder themselves from this massive empire. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to do was to try to create a kind of a gothic setting that seemed almost like a fairy tale, and then gradually to have the reader recognize, just as the character does, that the situation is not what they expect, right, and that really they're in a familiar place, but looking at it from a very unfamiliar angle.
That's exactly what happens. As Octavian goes from 4 to 5 to 6 years old, the scales start to drop away from his eyes, and he sees and we see that he really is in colonial New England. And Octavian ends up running away and becomes a part of the Revolutionary War. Now we're suddenly in a very different book. Now he's crawling along in the mud alongside other fighters. Tell us what you wanted to express there.
I really wanted to highlight the complicated set of decisions that people were making in that period, once again, before they knew what it meant to be an American or to think of yourself as anything other than a British citizen. What kind of decision would this character make about which side he was going to fight on?
We've spoken on this program with Gary Nash, author of the terrific book, The Forgotten Fifth, African Americans in the Age of Revolution. And we talked at that time about the unbelievable hypocrisy of the colonists. They were fighting for their freedom, but they didn't want that to extend to their slaves. And the British, on the other hand, offered freedom to the slaves who would cross over and fight for them. So there was this fear on the part of the colonists that any day they'd wake up and their slaves would revolt against them.
The American attitude towards African Americans in their rank in general was very, very complicated throughout the war. One of the first things that Washington did when he arrived at Cambridge, Massachusetts, during the Siege of Boston, was that he forbade African Americans from being enlisted because he was far too worried about the idea of black men with guns. Another thing, for example, General Sumter later on in the war was literally giving away slaves to those who would enlist in the American army.
And American slaves could fight instead of their owners. They could be sent to take the place of their owners.
Exactly, right. And so you have a system like this, and yet at the other hand, you look at it and you say, but this was, it ended up being the most integrated army ethnically that America had up until the time of the Vietnam War.
As I said in the beginning, at the outset, this is not your quaint little fife and drum tale. It's Dickensian.
Because the period could be. It was a very long and bitter war, really. There's a startling statistic, and these statistics are hard to actually get very precisely, but something like 4,500 people died in battle. And something like 60,000 people died of starvation and disease. And that gives you a sense that the simple heroism of the war that we picture, the sort of the men in wigs and nice-looking coats with the shafts of light falling down upon them from the heavens, that is less part of this war than the horrors that people were going through on a day-to-day basis, just trying to get food in freezing camp situations, walking without shoes through the snow. The heroism of the people, both of our country and of Britain's, it comes through, I think, even more when you think of the hideous conditions under which the war was fought.
Well, this is Volume 1. It's called The Pox Party because before he escapes, Octavian joins all the scientists and they get smallpox vaccinations. This was very common at the time. It was a party, only some people ultimately die of the pox. Meanwhile, the subtitle of the book is Traitor to the Nation. In the second volume, does he join the British?
Yeah, what happens in book two, one of the things that happens is that he joins Lord Dunmore's Ethiopian Regiment, which was a real regiment raised in Virginia as an attempt to pull support away from the Patriots and gain a kind of immediate British army down there of freed African-American slaves.
And again, the British lured the American slaves with the promise of freedom after a British victory. But we know how that story ended, so what happens to Octavian Nothing? We'll have to wait and see. Volume 2, The Kingdom on the Waves, won't be out till next October. But M.T. Anderson's award-winning first volume is out in paperback tomorrow, so you can get ready. And this closing thought on this day. The real Octavians and their descendants would, of course, wait almost 100 years for true freedom, the passing of the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery in 1865. They'd wait almost another 100 years for the true right to vote. How remarkable, given that miserable track record, that today, a mere 40 years later, presidential candidates are falling all over themselves to court that vote. Enjoy your Martin Luther King Day. We'll leave you with the music of the Blind Boys of Alabama. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now. Free at last.